It's a little nosy man, this little girl is fine.
Our next guest on Downtown has racked up 23 top 100 hits on the Billboard charts through the years, 6 top 10s, a couple of number ones, including that one from 1962. He's the author of a terrific book, From Cabbage Town to Tinseltown and Places in Between. And recently, USA Today, in their list of the absolute best songs in history, chose his 1969 smash Dizzy as one of the top 100 best songs of all time. We are pleased to be joined this afternoon on Downtown by singer-songwriter Tommy Roe. First of all, how are you feeling? It was not quite a year ago that you had pretty major surgery.
Yeah, July 27th will be 1 year. I had quadruple bypass surgery, and it just kind of snuck up on me. I tell you what happened. I was at the Atlanta airport, and I was feeling good up until I get off the plane, and I couldn't walk to the baggage claim. I was so out of breath. And I thought, wow, that's really weird. You know, first time that happened to me. So I kind of fluffed it off. It went away. And a few nights later, in the middle of the night, I wake up with this terrible chest pain and the same thing, out of breath. I said, uh-oh, body's screaming at me, something's wrong.
Mm.
So I go and I have an angiogram. And sure enough, I have 90% blockage of my main artery. And my heart doctor put me right in the hospital. She didn't even let me go home. And 3 days later, I had the operation. I mean, it was that fast. And I tell you, in a way, I was really lucky, because if I'd have fluffed it off, you know, anything could have happened. I could have had a stroke or anything. So I really have to count my lucky stars that I just went ahead and had it attended to, you know.
Well, we're so glad everything has worked out and you're feeling great and back in the news.
Yeah.
People talking about you all over the place here, thanks to USA Today listing the absolute best songs in history. And right there in the list from 50 years ago is Dizzy.
Number 91, man. I snuck in there in the 100. I mean, that was such an honor. You know, of course, at this stage in my career, any compliment or award is well received by T. Rowe. So I was really pleased to see that as a songwriter. That's really cool, you know.
Well, I want to talk. We'll talk about Dizzy a little bit later on, but I want to talk about the start of your career. You wrote a wonderful book about your experiences from Cabbage Town to Tinseltown and places in between. How did you go there in 1962 from rural Georgia, from Cabbage Town, all the way to the top of the Billboard charts?
Well, I tell you, it was kind of an interesting journey. I was, you know, at 14, I don't know if you've heard this story or not, but I wrote Sheila, which was originally called Frida, when I was 14 years old. And I wrote the song for a little girl I had kind of chased around the playground. We had a kind of a semi-young crush on each other, I guess. But I wrote this poem for her, and then a few months later, my dad taught me 3 chords on the guitar, and I thought, well, if I could put some music to these crazy little poems I'm writing, who knows, maybe I could become a songwriter. So I started pursuing that. And so I carried Frida around in my back pocket for a couple of years. Sweet little Frida, you know, if you see her, blue eyes and a ponytail. And I had a chance to make a record locally in Atlanta. And I met this record producer, and I sang Frida for him. He said, man, I love that song, Frida, but I'm not crazy about the title. See if you can come up with a different title. So we came up with Sheila. And as we like to say, when there's nothing left to say, there's the rest is history. I mean, the song became my first number one in 1962 and my first gold record.
And that would lead to a huge tour where a little group from England called the Beatles were the opening act for you.
Yeah, an unknown group at the time. Quite an amazing story. Earlier in 1962, I did the tour with Sam Cooke through the South with Chris Montez. So I met Chris Montez on that tour. And our agent wanted to book us in England, and we both accepted the tour. And we were the headliners of the tour. And we go over there, and there's this featured act on our tour called the Beatles. Nobody really knew who the Beatles were at this time. They'd only done, I think they did one other tour with Helen Shapiro, I think, before our tour. And so here we go. We go out on this tour. The Beatles, and they. When I first met them, I thought they were actually our backup band for the tour, you know. And they had two bands there. One band was our backup band, and then you had the Beatles. And we got along great. We met each other and talked. And, of course, I was really surprised with their look. You know, it was totally unconventional as far as American artists were concerned with the hair, you know, and the whole thing.
Right.
And they dressed really neat in suits and everything, suits and tie. So we do the tour, and Beatlemania takes off on our tour. I used to joke with John. I said, you know, John, because of Chris and I, you guys are going to become big stars. Because it all happened on our tour. It was like the springboard for the Beatles.
Now, is the story right? We're talking to Tommy Rowe here on Downtown. You came back to the States, and you had a recording. I guess it was at a test pressing or a demo from the Beatles, and you took it in to Felton Jarvis and gave a listen, but nobody here wanted to sign that group.
Well, I developed a good relationship with their manager on that tour, and what was their manager's name?
Brian Epstein.
Brian Epstein. My goodness, the mind is going here. But I developed a good relationship with Brian on that tour, and he was talking to my manager about handling me in Europe, managing me in Europe, you know. What's interesting about that is Brian or the Beatles didn't have a clue what was in store for them. I mean, they were just, you know, he was trying to develop a group of artists that he could manage, you know. So they were talking about managing me, and he asked me if I would take a promo pack back to my label and see if they would be interested in signing the Beatles. And, of course, I agreed to do that. He gave me, actually, it was just a little plastic bag from Nim's record, from his record store, you know, with their album in it and a bio and a photo and that kind of thing, you know. So I come back to the States. I take the Queen Elizabeth back, which I wanted to enjoy that. It was kind of an interesting trip, 5-day trip across the Atlantic. And I came into the docks in New York City, and Felton met me there in the docks. And I'd been hyping him on the Beatles the whole tour. About how, you know, I was telling them it's like Elvis all over again. You know, they're creating pandemonium wherever they go, chaos at the concerts, the whole thing. So he was very interested, and he met me at the docks. We went right to Sam Clark's office in New York with my little promo pack and Felton all excited. We're all excited about the Beatles. And we go in the office, and they congratulate me on the tour, and they say, I understand the tour went great, and it's good to have you back, and you've got to make some new records, and all of that small talk. And then Sam says, I understand Felton tells me that you found an act you would like for us to consider signing to our label. I said, yeah, they're called the Beatles. And, it just got quiet in the office, especially when I showed them the album cover, the front cover of the Beatles. The office got quiet. I mean, it was amazing. And Felton said, well, you got to listen to them. So he takes the album out of the cover and puts it on the turntable. Drops the needle, plays a few bars of the song, picks up the needle, looks at Felton, and he says, I tell you what, kid, let us be the talent scouts. That's got to be the worst piece of crap I've ever heard in my life. So Felton and I are standing there with our jaws dropping and thinking, we just knew we had the next Elvis, right? And to hear these guys just laugh us out of the office. I mean, we were devastated. And, of course, 6 months later, the Beatles happened. And I tell you a funny story. I used to go to these record promos in Miami. They'd have these where you'd meet the executives and you'd go down and promote your record and the whole thing. And the next one of those I went to, they used to have this cabana at the Eden Rock Hotel. And I walk out by the pool towards their cabana, and they all run for the exits. Here comes the kid that brought us the Beatles. It's embarrassing.
Well, when they finally did come here to America, you got to work with them again, opening for them at the big show in Washington, D.C.
Yes, Brian Epstein asked me if I would open for them on their first concert. You know, they did the Ed Sullivan show on, I think it was, I forgot the dates, but the concert was on February 11th, 1964. And they did the Ed Sullivan show, and then 2 days later was the concert, and they took a train down to do the concert. And, of course, I agreed to do that, and I opened for them. And still, even at that time, Brian and the Beatles didn't have a clue what was in store, what was about to happen to them. I mean, they didn't need an opening act. I mean, what do they need an opening act for? But they didn't know that. They thought that's the way it was done, you know, so they had to have an opening act. So the Chiffons and myself were the opening act for the Beatles on that show. And then after that, you know, it was Beatlemania from then on out.
Tommy, you talk in your book wonderful stories and harrowing stories in many ways. And you mentioned touring with Sam Cooke, what it was like touring in the South in the midst of segregation in the 1960s.
Yeah, that was the first big tour I did. And, you know, I was such a fan of Sam Cooke. And on that tour, there were several, it was an all-black troupe, you know. And they had Curtis Mayfield and Impressions, Sam Cooke, and several other acts on the show. And so that was my first tour. And to me, it was just all about the music. I wasn't even thinking about the segregated thing that was going on in the South. I mean, it shows how naive I was. I was a very naive kid. It was just all that was on my mind was music, you know, and touring with Sam Cooke. So I take on the tour, and we go out, and I find out that really the reason they have one white act on the tour is because during that time, during segregated times, they couldn't go into restaurants and eat.
Right.
And so I was kind of like a runner. You know, they would park the bus down the street a ways from a mom-and-pop restaurant. And mind you, you have to remember, back in those days, there were no McDonald's or Burger Kings or Kentucky Fried Chickens. They didn't exist. They were all mom-and-pop restaurants, you know. So I would get off the bus and walk back up the street to the little restaurant and order like 40 hamburgers or whatever, cheeseburgers or chicken or whatever it was everybody wanted. And I always got some really strange looks from the restaurants, you know, and I would have to come up with some kind of, my favorite story was, well, they'd say, well, why are you ordering so much food? What's going on? I said, well, it's like a fraternity stunt, you know, we're doing a fraternity stunt. I mean, if they knew that I was ordering all these, who knows, maybe they wouldn't have served me, you know? So I did that through the whole tour. You know, I was like the runner for everybody, and I didn't know that that's what was going on. I thought, of course, I had the number one record in the country, Sheila. So they were glad to have me on the tour because I had a big hit record, you know. And so we did the tour, finished the tour. But another thing, they couldn't stay in the hotels either, you know. So
that's right,
they dropped me off at some little mom and pop hotel, and then they would go into the community and stay in people's houses or churches or some of the black hotels, and then the next morning they'd pick me up and we'd go to the next gig, you know. So quite a learning experience for me, for a naive 20-year-old, you know. And I actually got kind of dangerous towards the end. I was getting threats from, you know, the whites and the blacks. It was like, you know, it was kind of dangerous. So my manager pulled me off the tour in Nashville.
Well, I was looking at some of the pictures on your website, which is a great website, by the way, and looking at that, boy, the group of talent that assembled down in Muscle Shoals at Fame Studios with Rick Hall, Felton, yourself, Ray Stevens, Norbert Putnam, what a talented crew.
Yeah, that was the when I cut everybody. That was the everybody session. And, of course, everybody turned out to be a top five record for me, you know. And they were just incredible musicians. I think they still they live in Nashville now, all of those guys. Ray, of course, has the Cabaret Theater he built there now, which is going great. And I did his TV show a few months ago, and he has the Cabaret TV show.
Right.
So I don't know if you saw it, I have a picture of Ray in 1963 when we were working on the Sheila album. And then a picture of me in 2017 when I did his TV show. Did you see that one?
I saw those two together. They're great, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting contrast, you know, so many years apart, and we're still friends and still doing what we do, you know.
I mean, one of the things that separated you from a lot of the people who had a bunch of hits is the fact that you wrote your own songs. You were able to perform and write in a lot of different styles, too. And I look at Dizzy, which, I mean, that thing just blew up 50 springs ago, 4 weeks at number one. And yeah. People think of that as, well, you get the label of it being a bubblegum song. But that's an incredibly complex song. What are there, about a dozen key changes in that song?
Yes, it is. It modulates, so you can't modulate anymore.
And you wrote that with Freddie Weller, right?
I did. That was the first big hit that Freddie and I wrote together. And the way Freddie and I were friends in Atlanta. He used to be the guitarist for Billy Joe Royal and Joe South. He worked with both of those guys. And so when I went out to California after I got out of the service, I'd written Sweet Pea to try to keep it stay in the charts. I called it soft rock, you know, which turned out to be the first bubblegum song of mine. And I'd written that while I was in the Army, and I recorded it in California. So when I went to California, I also got the gig on Where the Action Is with the Dick Clark show in the afternoon. I was like a regular on that show with Paul Revere and the Raiders.
Right.
And Paul lost his guitarist, and he was asking me if I knew somebody, and I suggested he get in touch with Freddie, you know, that he might be interested in coming out and joining the Raiders. So he called Freddie, and Freddie came out and auditions, and Freddie got the job. So here we are, two friends from Atlanta touring together. He's playing guitar with Paul Revere and the Raiders, and of course I'm doing all the Dick Clark tours with them. And Freddie and I start writing songs together. Well, Dizzy was one of the first songs we wrote, and we wrote it on a bus tour, touring one night late at night, you know, with our guitars on the bus. And we started writing, we actually finished it later, but we started it on that tour. And then, you know, after that, we wrote Jam Up Jelly Tight. We wrote quite a few country songs that Freddie recorded and did quite well. So we just kind of, it was kind of a good situation for us that we became good pals. And he's my writing partner. We still have a new EP out, actually, which has one of our songs on it called Cabbage, it was originally called Birmingham, and I changed it to Cabbage Town to promote the book, you know. And it's called Tommy Rowe Meets Barefoot Jerry.
Mm. And you recorded the song, Dizzy, with all those great L.A. session musicians, our friend, the late and amazingly great Hal Blaine, and that whole terrific Wrecking Crew.
Yes, I was very fortunate to hook up with those great musicians. I had, you know, when I cut Sheila and everybody in Nashville and Muscle Shoals, I had the cream of the crop on those sessions. They were the A-list musicians. And when I moved out to California, I hooked up with Hal, Joe Osborne, Larry Nechtold, Ben Benet, all those great musicians in California. And we recorded Dizzy and Jam Up Jelly Tight. Heather Honey was with Hal. And Stagger Lee I cut with Hal. All of those great songs, you know. So they were a tremendous group of musicians, I tell you. And I was very fortunate to have them on my team.
Well, whatever people want to call it, soft rock, bubblegum music, or just great, singable, unforgettable music. You've been making people smile for about 65 years or so now by making great music. We play a lot of your songs here on the station, and you hear a Tommy Rowe song, you can't help but smile and feel good, and there's not much better legacy than that.
It's called happy music. It's called happy music. That's what we like to call it. But I tell you, Rich, I get a great thrill when I go on stage and I sing Sweet Pea or Hooray for Hazel, Dizzy, one of my songs, and I see this big smile on the face of my audience. It seems to bring out, you know, the happiness of my shows. It's just overwhelming, you know, and it's really what it's all about for me at this stage of my career. Like you said, I've been in this over 55 years, and I've seen a lot of things come and go, and a lot of styles come and go, but there's still an affinity for 60s happy music, and it's been a real blessing for me.
Tommy, thank you so much. It's been great to talk with you. So glad to hear you're feeling well, and we appreciate you making time for us here today.
It's my pleasure, Rich. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
What a good guy, Tommy Rowe, looking back on his terrific career here on Downtown Retro Radio.